We know that you will love this podcast. So shut your mouth and listen to Canadian Bushcraft.
Hello, Dragonfly Nation. This is episode 20 of the Canadian Bushcraft Podcast with your host, Caleb Musgrave. And I am so thankful for you all for tuning in for 20 episodes. You are troopers for listening to me rant like a maniac in a basement 20 times over. I'm joined here yet again by my good buddy, Rye the Adventure Guy. And Rye, well, we just
pulled me off the shelf.
Dusted you off.
A month ago or so, we did our last one. I've just been sitting there patiently waiting.
Just up there. Yeah. You want me to come over for a podcast? We even tried it last Friday to get together, and then some family commitments came together. Community needs came first. So, sadly, we haven't had a couple of podcasts in a while. We've missed a couple of dates. Apologies for that, folks. But we are back up and running. We are running full tilt, and we are going to be talking tonight about canoe trip gear. Our previous episode, episode 19, talked about backpacking gear and what we recommend if you're just getting into backpacking. This episode, we want to get into what you should take with you, what we think is good things to think about as gear-wise, or even provisions or equipment, or just things to keep in your mind when you're preparing for a canoe trip. Just under a month ago, Ryan and I and our good friend Radic went on a four-day canoe trip. What was it for?
Two nights
sounds right. And we just went up to the Haliburton Highlands, a beautiful area than the Haliburton Highlands. We went from Wren to Raven to Gun Lake, I believe, was the trip that we did. Beautiful area. Absolutely beautiful.
It's like a nice little gateway to Algonquin Park because you're like right up there on the southern edge of Algonquin, but it's kind of like a best-kept secret. Everybody thinks Algonquin whenever they Google Canadian canoe routes, Ontario canoe routes.
Yep.
Where do I go? Algonquin, Colorado. Okay.
French River.
Yeah.
Right. We talked about a few episodes back, actually. We were talking about like our favorite canoe routes and all those kinds of journeys. We forgot all about the French and the Magneto ones.
That's the ones we just get talking and then we're running out of time. Yep. And all of a sudden you get there and you're sitting there for the first 5 minutes afterwards and you're like, oh my God, there's so many places I forgot to talk about.
How do we forget that one? We're going to look like idiots to everyone.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we did a nice little trip. It's a beautiful little area to go into. Check out the Haliburton Highlands if you ever get a chance. But while we're on that trip, I got to thinking again about, like, we want to do this, like, little mini-series within the podcast of, like, gear trips, gears geared towards specific trips. And it kind of hit me home when we got to one of our first, one of our only big portages on that whole thing. Very short portage. We did one, nothing was over 400 meters. Yeah. I think that one was 348 or 358 or something like that. But right when we were getting up there, I had Sushi. If you don't know, Sushi is our little puppy. She's just a year old now. Border Collie Basset Hound mix. And this is her first time in a canoe, period. In a boat, period. And she's never been really keen on water. So we were having some struggles with her. And when we got to that second portage before Gun Lake, I quickly realized I brought the wrong bag because she immediately flipped us as soon as we got near the portage. And Ryan got to sit back and watch as I toppled right over. The dog was right up under the canoe. The canoe was completely capsized. Luckily, there was a big pocket of air and she had a life jacket on. So it wasn't a lot of work to pull her out and get the canoe righted. But I brought myself my backpack that I take on almost every trip. My trip to Colombia, my trip out to Nova Scotia this past year, all my backpacking and my hunting trips since I got it last summer. It's a Savota pack, a beautiful rucksack. I absolutely love it, but it's not really made for a canoe trip. And that got me thinking again, like, we're doing this mini series on gear. Let's talk about gear that's like geared towards canoes. And I think the first one for me is a pack made for a canoe trip. And that would be a canoe pack, specifically is what they're usually called. And it's basically a big dry sack with shoulder straps, and it's made to fit you a little bit more comfortably than if you just put a big bag on your back. They're truly waterproof. They're locked down. The one that I actually have ironically sitting here that I've had for years, hanging right behind me, which we could have had for this entire trip. It's got like 7 or 8 different latches to lock everything down nice and tight, cinch everything down so it's not, you know, too big and bulky. And the beautiful thing about these things is because they're a heavy duty vinyl, they're really durable. You can bounce them off rocks. You can smash them against the ground, drag them up off the out of the water, and they're going to be fairly waterproof. I wouldn't say like they're 100,000% waterproof, but they're going to be fairly waterproof compared to a rucksack or backpack.
You've got the Sea Lion Boundary Pack. Am I correct? It looks like.
Well, I believe it.
From here, it looks like.
I believe it is.
It's not the like guiding level $300 one with all the back padding.
It might be actually. I'm going to step up and just look real quick. Now that I'm curious, because I haven't actually looked at it.
Those ones normally, I think, are yellowish color. But yeah, it's got a decent little bit of structure to it and adjustable. So okay. It's not your bottom line one, but. The ones I really like about the Sea Lion is has the double strip at the top.
Yes.
A lot of the cheaper ones you'll find will just have like one simple strip, and that's not normally enough. At least when you can fold over those two strips on each other, adds that double rigidity.
Yeah, and it makes it a little bit more of a secure seal. The main thing when we're talking about camping gear for a canoe trip. It either has to be totally okay being soaking, sopping wet, or it needs to be waterproofed in some way. Don't do what I did and bring a rucksack and then throw in those ultralight, quote unquote, air quote, dry sacks. Do the canoe pack and then use those. Or if you're going to take a rucksack, bring those heavy duty vinyl Sea Lion. I think Sea to Summit makes some heavy duty ones now.
Yeah.
They weren't when I first started buying their dry sacks.
Well, even when you first start, everybody kind of starts out with the Ziploc bags, the heavy-duty freezer bags and stuff, and that's perfect. That's still, I even just like kept a bunch aside that I would normally use for trip. I put them aside after the trip, and then reuse them again, just so I'm not scattering them all over the place and end up in the garbage sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always a good little one, and they're see-through too, so you can see everything that's inside.
You had a dry sack on the trip that I fell in love with.
My NRS.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. It was completely clear. It was heavy vinyl material or heavy plastic material, but you could see everything inside. So there's none of that rummaging around trying to find that one thing you need right now.
Exactly. I find they're really good for first aid kits where you have everything with your trauma kit and everything inside so you know exactly where you need to dig to.
Totally.
Instead of just being like, crap, empty everything out of the bag and toss it back in sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's really helps and like even items. Like I was keeping the kitchen gear with like the camp fuel and my dragonfly stove and everything.
And there's on that note, there's other containers you can choose. There's also like the Pelican case style waterproof boxes. I've been using them. I have one down here that I got probably when I was 11 or 12 years old, and I'm still using it all. I took it to Columbia with me last summer, and I used it to store all of my electrical equipment because I really do trust it. You gotta spend the money on the right ones. Don't go cheap on those because I find that the O-rings or the gaskets or the seals on the real cheap ones, and even like the okay priced ones, you just if they're fully submerged, you're not gonna be able to trust it. Same thing with those Sea to Summit. It was kind of like almost like a Sil nylon bag.
Yeah,
they're
just like a nylon bag that's been sprayed and treated.
Yeah.
Kind of clog up.
And that was my mistake, is I had a rucksack with two or three of those bags in there. Luckily, the one was just my shelter, my hammock, and my tarp, so it doesn't really matter. They dry in 5 minutes. But if I had my clothes in one of those bags, I would have been miserable for the rest of the trip. I would have been laying everything out and waiting for all of my gitches to dry and all my socks to dry. I would have been miserable.
Even I love those old-fashioned portage packs that are just like those big square kind of rectangular bags, but then you can just like there's ones that come in like 90 liters or something like that, and you can fit like 3 30-liter
they're perfect
Sea Lion bags in there, just so you can have okay, here's my tent, here's all my gear, like my
here's my food,
and stuff like that, and here's my food. So,
and then in between you can tuck in like here's my saw, here's my axe, here's my first aid kit. You can kind of wiggle it in between the three bags inside the big portage bag.
That's always one of my big things, like whether it's backpacking or canoeing, it's always really compartmentalizing everything in your pack. Get them really organized just so you're not just pulling through everything, tossed it in there as is.
Yeah. And you can even color code. Because these dry bags come in different colors, I always went with, when I had all my Sea Lion vinyl ones, the blue one was always like food and water. The black one was shelter because it's nighttime. And then red was all my clothes because I always have a red plaid jacket and stuff like that. So when you're kind of, you get to base camp, you're kind of trying to get everything together. You can put that headlamp on and look in the bag and like, okay, that's the one I need. Just pull that one out. Here we go.
Yeah. leave it in case of emergency. If you've got your wilderness first responder and then you're on a trip guiding some people on it and you're busy taking care of someone at the time, like, go into my bag, grab the red bag, bring it to me sort of thing. So they're not like, hey, can I get my first aid kit that's in this indiscretionary kind of like just gray pack? And they're like, which one? There's five of them.
It's in the backpack.
It's in the lid.
And that's another thing, like, on my packs, I carry my first aid kit right on the outside. And before we go on any trip, Ryan can verify this. I tell everybody exactly, like, this is my first aid kit. If something goes down, here it is, right here.
That's always the best thing to do whenever you're starting off a trip.
On any kind of trip.
That front loading of understanding where everybody's, where everyone's health cards are located, stuff like that. That's always something, well, meeting trips, you're always making sure you're privy to start is you have everybody's health cards in one location. It's always good just to even have a photocopy of your health card ready to go and any other just like health data sheets where you're like letting everybody know of any allergies. I can't have penicillin. I can't do any of this. I have with me my inhaler with me. It's located in this pocket of this bag sort of thing. So it's always good to have like a little plan ready for people to go in case you're not able to provide them with that.
Totally.
So that's always a good idea to have, is like a little kit where like you can let anyone that just comes across knows where everything's located. So
totally. And on a different, like on the same line but on a different note, on my hunting vest I have a little Molly trauma pack that sits right beside my neck.
Yeah.
And it's bright orange just like the vest, and it has a first aid logo on it. And inside is like a Israeli tourniquet, the compression packs, all that kind of stuff for a gunshot wound. On the off chance that I come across somebody that's been injured or I am the one that gets shot, I want people to immediately know where that first aid kit on me is so that I can get my ass saved as fast as possible. So it's as much of a selfish reason, but it's also for the greater good of the community or the greater good of the crew to make sure that your first aid gear is first visible and easily accessible, and all your medical emergency stuff is there. Make sure you have it. Everybody should have their own, but make sure that if you're like leading a trip, that you've got a huge repertoire of background on wilderness first responder training, water rescue, all that kind of stuff. Make sure you have that before you go. And even if you're not a guide, if you're not trying to be a leader on these kind of trips, don't be afraid to go and take these courses. I'm sure Ryan can speak on that more than I can, on how valuable that stuff is.
I think it's with the wilderness first responder that kind of sets you up to be a leader and be more like a backcountry EMS sort of thing. You understand how to give needles to people, how to properly set that up, how to like get everything going. Rather than, because I think just for someone who's going off and does like a yearly camping trip, it's good to have a basic first aid so you understand splinting and
You don't need to do a tracheotomy.
Yeah, because there's a lot of people that will just like go online and look up all the advanced techniques and then think they've got it all down pat and do more harm than good. They're doing tracheotomies in the backcountry, which is a big.
I watched I watched Anaconda. I got a pen knife and a pen.
Someone got a pen. Take that out. Just, I'm punching the.
Stay still, Owen Wilson. I'll save you.
So and especially things like tourniquets and stuff like that. If you don't know how to properly use those.
Yeah.
Then it's better to go with that sort of thing.
Totally. Always stay within your wheelhouse. Don't step out of there unless you really have the training, and then you're still in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, because there's places where I've got my woofer. They were the ones who provided me with all that, paid for it and everything, got lucky there. But then there, you have to really look with, if you're working for a guiding company, what their regulations are. Because we've learned so many things, and then they're like, no traction in line. If it's like, if you get a dislocation or something like that, just splint it and then bring it back, and we'll bring it to the hospital, and then they can pop it out and put it back
right.
Stuff like that. It's like, they just taught us how to do that. So at the same time, because the only injury like that I've had before is a dislocated finger, where their finger ended up bent like an S.
Ooh.
So just right at the knuckle, it popped out. They were walking along their canoe at the end of a portage, put their canoe in the water, had their paddle in one hand. They slipped and fell. The paddle came down. Their hand hit the top of the gunwale, paddle right on top of the knuckle, and then bent it right out of place.
Oh.
Luckily, we're about three portages from, like, this was up near Cedar Lake, Brent, in northern Algonquin.
Okay, so, yeah, yeah.
We were just on, like, the Petawawa or something like that.
Right.
So.
Well, that's a lucky one.
They couldn't carry much across the portage. They're like, we want to help, we want to help. Like, no, just take care of your hand right now.
That can be, and that's another thing for folks. We're kind of getting away from the gear talk, but if you're injured on a trip, stop trying to be helpful. Just do what you're told, and if they're telling you to sit still, sit still. Please stop trying to be. I'm the worst at that. Trust me. Talk to my wife. Talk to my friends. If I cut myself open, I'm the one trying to apply all the bandaging.
And
the
anxiety
I'm the one.
Is already high enough that yeah. Just like, oh, I'm sorry to put you guys in this position already. What can I do to help? But yeah. At the same time, sometimes the best help is just getting out of the way.
Stay still and let the masters do their work. Simple
especially
as that.
Like you want to keep. If you have any cuts or anything like that, you want to keep your heart rate down just so you're not getting working yourself up by doing more work and
yeah.
Out a little bit.
Or if you got a bad enough sprain or a dislocation, you're going to be dealing with shock potentially. And yeah. If you start trying to be active with shock, things can go worse.
Well, especially that those first couple of hours, you still got that adrenaline kicking in. So you're thinking, oh, it's not that big of a deal or anything mm-hmm. like that. But it's just good just to sit back. And you're lucky if you have someone who has that sort of advanced training. To help you out with it rather than just a bunch of people like, hey, let's go canoeing for the first time. Uh-oh, what do we do now?
Yeah. So outside of first aid gear and canoe packs and dry sacks and dry gear, what do you think is good stuff for someone to take with them if they're going on a canoe trip? The beauty, before I let you talk, because I'm already talking over you again, the beauty of a canoe trip compared to a backpacking trip is you can kind of bring more because the canoe is now the vessel moving you except for portages. So we can bring more. What kind of things, building off what we talked about in the backpacking episode, what gear should we be thinking about?
Well, I think for starters, there is a little more legality involved with this sort of thing. So there is like legal things you need to have with you in your canoe that you don't often see with a lot of people. But luckily these days with like canoe rentals, they'll provide you all the legal items that mm-hmm. you need. First of all, you need some sort of tow rope.
Mm-hmm.
Need everyone with a PFD. Right. Sometimes it's even good just to have a spare, just in case you have a strap that rips off yours or you forget it somewhere. Sometimes people get so they take their PFD off and they're so used to the freedom of not having it on anymore. They put it down the side of the trail, you keep going, and it could be like a 5 kilometer portage, and then you're walking back and forth trying to figure out where you put it down and stuff like that. Although it does, like, when you do have a spare, I've found that you're more likely to kind of leave it behind because you have the one that's on you, and then you're figuring, oh, crap.
Why would I carry this thing?
Thing like that.
The only real benefit for me to have a spare is I'm often, because I'm a top-heavy guy, sitting on the seats of a canoe often leads to me flipping a canoe. So I often end up kneeling. We were talking about this before. I often am in, like, kind of a whitewater position on the bottom of the canoe, kneeling, and depending on the material, that can be really abrasive to your kneecap. So having that extra PFD, I often use as a kneeling pad.
Well, that's also something that you don't think about, but you also have to be a little aware of, because if you're sitting on it and kneeling on it, you're really compressing
that's true.
Inside. So they recommend a lot not to do sort of things like that, because I know
good point.
The camps I've worked at, people like the counselors who've been there for 10 years and stuff like that, I was like, oh, just use that as your little camp seat back. At camp, but then you go through session after session with kids after kids using this thing week after week, and then all of a sudden by the end of it you get this
thin.
Little sandwich wafer thin that provides no buoyancy because it's all the trapped air pockets within that provide the buoyancy.
Totally.
So it's one thing, like, it's okay to use now and again, but don't get too comfortable with always kneeling and sitting on top of your PFD. You don't want to.
I've never actually considered that.
Yeah.
That's a great point to bring up.
Well, even PFDs in general have a lifespan.
That's true.
So anything like that, the foam will deteriorate, it'll harden, and after a while, it just doesn't provide the same buoyancy. I can't remember. I think the standard average for buoyancy is 7 pounds you need, because like our bodies weigh like 20 times less when they're in the water, sort of thing. So, like, the whitewater ones you'll get are between like 12 and 15 pounds of buoyancy sort of thing. So that's
guarantee
because,
that your head's way up.
Oh yeah, because in whitewater you've got so many air bubbles, and those bubbles, once you're in that, they just flatten out, pop out, and then that's why you have a harder time staying afloat in whitewater sort of things. So,
add the fact that like you have water rushing right past your face, the higher your head is, the better you can breathe.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. That's why they're designed to really provide you that extra buoyancy to get you out of that water so you don't just get sucked down into it.
So tow rope, PFD, the bale?
Tow rope, PFD, bales. I've seen so many different bales out there. I've even used my Nalgene before as a backup. Sometimes you get like a heavy pour down, you have like two people just going at it, getting the bale going. Yeah, I've seen like detergent bottles, those big Sunlight ones, just cut them in half and it already has
a little handle
on it for you. But then you'll also get those like Fox 40.
I was going to mention, I saw one of those in Radix kit, I think it was.
Yeah, and those are the ones that you'll normally get with a canoe rental, is they'll just give you one of those because it has like a little yellow rope in there, just PVC rope.
And that's the one thing to kind of bring up. I was going to mention when you mentioned throw rope, it's got to be a buoyant rope.
Buoyant, yeah.
It can't be your Fox, you your 540 paracord.
Yeah. Below the water, and all of a sudden the guy floating out there.
Here, grab this. Yeah. Okay, let me try that again. Okay, grab. Don't try to use an anchor.
I think it needs to be at least 25 feet. And then you see some of those other ones, like the Fox 40, big orange ones with like 70 feet of rope. Then a lot of the times I've seen people even just cut those short without ruining its integrity and stuff They use one of those hot wires to kind of cut it.
Yeah. I used to do that at the hardware store when I was a kid and have to cut rope for folks. I love that gadget.
Yeah.
Those are great.
Yeah, it's one of those things you just want to have it nice and thick and buoyant. Because, like, occasionally you will have to tow a broken canoe behind you. You're with another boat, they crack their hull, and they can no longer support themselves in it, but you can possibly keep their gear still in it. You'll just have to toss them in your canoe and then tow it behind you.
Right.
So, and they're normally static rope, they're not a lot of kinetic, big, bouncy, boring line sort of like that. You want something that's a little stronger, a little stretch too much.
Yeah.
So,
We got tow rope, we've got a bale, we've got a PFD whistle.
Whistle. You want some sort of signaling device.
Yeah, overall, definitely.
You want a whistle, a flashlight, depending if you're going out early mornings, dusk, dawn sort of situations, heavy fog.
Or if you want to go out and do a night paddle, you need to have that light on you because there may be other boats on the water.
There'll be other boats on the water that need to be signified towards your presence.
Yeah.
And just also there will be those times where you thought you were only an hour away from where your final destination was, and then the sun just sets real quick on you. And then you're like, where was that portage again? I'm just seeing this dark outline of a shoreline.
Yeah.
But luckily enough, mostly these days, the portage signs will be reflective.
Yeah.
And the campsite signs will be reflective. So even if you just scan across where you think the shoreline is,
you'll see something light up.
Yellow glimmer in the distance, that little orange glimmer. So.
And there's a lot of people, I've met a lot of people that don't take any of this stuff with them in their canoes. And I brought it up with a few friends of mine in the past, and they were always like, oh, come on, man. It's just a canoe. Like, I don't need all this stuff. Let me remind everybody that it wasn't too long ago that the province of Ontario was discussing canoe licenses because of how many people have drowned in these vessels. And the compromise was an MTO-approved water rescue kit, including a bale, a tow rope, a whistle, and a light. And wearing a PFD. That was the compromise. We keep being stupid and not doing this. They can get rid of the compromise any day, and we'll all have to be registered, licensed canoers. And that's...
I'm a bit of a fan of that, but...
I'm not against
it. You have to worry just about the accessibility and people pumping up the prices. Oh, you have to spend $200 to get this license.
Exactly.
And then suddenly people were already against the edge with money and funds. And
now they can't just do it.
But...
And that's where I kind of sit. Like, I'm not against having a canoe license, but all these people that are like, I don't need to carry this stuff. The government can't tell me to do. They can. And if you push this harder, they will make it even more restrictive on you. I don't think we need to get into why we both love the idea of a license for canoeing, but it saves a lot of people liability. It saves, especially for rentals and such.
Well, I was even seeing a story the other day just about broken canoes being left behind in certain parks and stuff like that. Just all these boats with big cracks in the bottom, and they like either hiked their way back out or else they got picked up by someone if they were whitewater canoeing and wrapped their canoe around a rock on the rapids. And but there are some people who will make the effort to go back to it and retrace their steps and get that boat and bring it back. And
but a lot don't
refurbish it or just like kind of turn it into a bookshelf or something like that. So I have one idea I heard someone talk about on the comment.
Yeah, we've had that actually when I worked. So I used to work at a summer camp up in Algonquin Park. I was not one of the tripping staff, but I went on a few trips and we had a terrible accident happen up in Temagami where multiple canoes went down like class 4 rapids that were not supposed to be there.
That's heard too many stories.
Yeah, wrapped canoes. One of the guides ended up practically quitting tripping altogether because of the trauma from what he went through, the PTSD. And we made sure that every single canoe that got wrapped around a rock came out of there. But that's because, for two reasons, that's because they're a good camp that's been around for over 100 years and they believe in the tradition of Leave No Trace. But B, every canoe had the company's name painted right on it. And they knew that if they left that canoe, someone's going to look into who from that camp would have left a canoe behind. There's a little bit of, what's the word, responsibility left behind that way.
Well, that's even a safety thing, too. If you're new to canoeing and stuff, have respect for the land you're on, not just like Leave No Trace, but don't get in over your head thinking, oh, this is just a simple rapid and stuff like that without understanding water and all that stuff, not scouting ahead on white water.
100%.
Like there's people that are, oh, I'm just going to go down this little roller coaster, lazy river ride in my canoe. And they don't think about getting twisted around, getting pinned against a rock, what to do in those situations.
Like, how do you paddle when you're facing upstream? Yeah. Like, all these kinds of things.
It's just getting caught in these holes where it's just all of a sudden turbulent.
Or a water barrel.
The water barrels.
Yeah.
I've heard stories about two guys being in one canoe and the rest of the pack behind them. Two guys go over, get sucked underneath, they drown, and then the other people are like,
there's no guys.
So
now we're alone.
And the guys were supposed to be the ones who knew what they were doing, but didn't really set up those contingencies.
Yeah.
Being in a situation, because who's going to save people that are trained to save you?
When we talk about a backcountry trip in a canoe, like you're increasing the risk. Backpacking and hiking has risks of strains, sprains, breaks, and falls. Canoes increase the odds of one of the most terrifying ways to die, and that is drowning.
Yeah.
So there's a reason for the last 30 minutes we've taught, well, 20 of the last 30 minutes, we've been hammering into your head safety equipment and rescue equipment.
Just even looking into what an SRT course entails and stuff like that. I've done stuff like that.
And what is SRT?
A swift river technician, something like that. Just moving water. There's so many different lingo and stuff like that, but SRT I think is the main one. But it's just like that I've known, of course, is when I was down in Costa Rica working with guys who do that sort of thing, they ran us through like a little tester kind of thing like that, because I helped run like a little woofer course in the jungle and stuff like that, out of stuff, and like get everybody through these little mountainous areas in Costa Rica where it's maybe 7-day hike to civilization.
Yeah.
But there's some guys who make people swim back and forth across the river 40 times before they actually start the drills and do everything, because people don't take into account just how tired you are after a long day of doing things. You're paddling out all day long. You start to know the campsite's nearby. You haven't seen it yet, but you start to smell the barn, and then you're getting yourself, oh, get it. Let's lay back a little bit. Let's take things easy now. And then you get into a situation, your arms are feeling like rubber. Your knees have been bent on the bottom of a canoe all day long, and suddenly you're like, normally you get out on the edge and you're like, I can't stand properly for the first 1 minute while the blood flow keeps going in. But it's a lot of fatigue goes into those sorts of things. So you got to be ready, and that's why you got to take things slow at all times.
100%.
Really have respect for the dangers that are out there. But other than those main safety things, talk about flashlights, throw rope, bailer, PFDs. There's like, when it comes to kayaking, there's reboarding devices and stuff like that. But just even in a canoe, understand how to do a canoe over canoe, a little T-rescue sort of thing. And that's a little thing that I thought about, is like, sometimes people have a really hard time getting back to a canoe.
Me.
Yeah. There's like, even just with the big PFDs you got out there these days, some people can't get over that little bit.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. But there's multiple ways to do it. There's eventually when you get into solo canoeing, knowing how to do a like solo rescue sort of thing, get yourself in there, get all the water out. So just as I was talking about, we've covered everything from much PFDs, sound signaling devices, a good P-less whistle, that's a big thing. Having a P-less, you don't want to have that little sticky plastic ball inside there that's getting stuck and not whistling.
Way back, I don't want to take us off too much on the side, but way back when we first started doing YouTube videos, we did a signals episode or signals video, and I mentioned P-less whistles, and people got on our case that we were saying P-less specifically. They're like, any whistle will do. I like my old tin whistle with its P in it. If it's full of water, that P doesn't work.
Yeah.
And if it's winter time and there's moisture in there, that P doesn't work.
Even
and without
those edge months where you just need a little water, you get a little freezing, but not fully frozen solid.
Yeah, it's not going to work. Whereas a classic Fox 40 or I really like those flat whistles, three tones that come with the Topps knives.
Yeah.
We have a design with Topps knives, the D-Fly 4.5, and it comes with one of those little flat whistles.
Sounds like a train whistle.
It really does. And that's what I love about it, because it doesn't sound like a bird call of any kind. Anybody hears that, they're like, is there a miniature train? It was Thomas.
Do you know how many decibels it is?
No, but I know it's loud. We've tested it at about 2 kilometers, and you can just hear it at 2.
Yeah.
So I figure at a 1K distance, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's up there I wouldn't say it's as good as the Fox 40, but it's pretty, for what it is, it's pretty damn nice.
Yeah, because I've got some of those Primo Fox 40 ones with the rubberized edges and everything like that, which are just like, they'll scream your ears off if you're nearby with something. You have to like warn people around before you use it.
There was another whistle out there called Jet Scream. For a while, it was made by the same people that I believe eventually bought out and made Survive Outdoor Longer SOL, but I don't know if they still make the Jet Scream whistle.
Yeah.
That thing deafened me, and I was the one blowing on it. I wasn't even blowing that hard. But again, P-less whistles. So, sorry, I didn't want to go too far, but P-less whistles.
That's just want something even decent. Like sometimes you'll get stuff, you just want to make sure you disinfect it if people are crossing, especially in today's age.
Yep.
You want to make sure you run it through a little rubbing alcohol between uses. Working at camps, that was always an issue. Something like that, making sure everything's nicely cleaned after everybody's spit into this for a while.
Definitely.
And you always got to worry with kids. Like, kids just start using them. Hey, look, we're having a rave. We're going to just be whistling all over the place.
And that's another good...
Terry Crews.
That's another good a good one to bring up on the topic of a rave. Glow sticks.
Yeah.
Or a great way to illuminate stuff when you're on trips. I've hung them at the latrine site so people can see it in the dark.
You loop them into your tent zipper.
Yeah. But also, like, we've done it where if we're going to do a night swim, sometimes you want to do that. Everybody brings one of those little bracelet glow sticks. They pop it on, and they're waterproof. They work in the water.
Yeah.
So everybody can be seen out there. No one's going missing. You're like, okay, five of us went in. I see 5 rings. Okay, we're good. Okay, why is there only 2? What's going on, folks?
I've even found like those. You'll find those glow sticks that are battery operated work really well for the latrine stuff, and so you can reuse it trip after trip.
Totally.
You're not just creating a big pile of plastic.
Yeah, that's a great point.
But yeah, they're always nice to have, especially middle of the night. You're wanting to drop a deuce, you can't find out where to go, so you find the closest tree, and then that's when you come across the campsite. And paper,
little tent cities of paper. Yep.
Yeah.
So beyond lights and whistles, what else do you think?
I think that's all the safety stuff. We got PFDs, sound signaling device, the buoyant line, a baler or a pump. You'll get pumps, but those are mostly for like kayaking and stuff, or just between your legs in a closed hot kayak.
Yep.
But you can always use those white water, flat water.
Yep.
Some it might be a little preferable for you. And then just knowing how to get in and out of the canoe safely, especially if you tip.
Definitely.
And then we're talking about compasses, I think, was one of the other ones I want to talk about.
Navigation,
Navigation. And just having a basic understanding of navigating with a compass. Because depending where you are, sometimes you'll be on a foggy day and you just have to landmark your way across a lake mm-hmm. depending how big it is. If you're on a little small area, sometimes you can see all of the sides a little bit.
Right.
A lot of people don't know. So map and compass are essential to have. Even if you don't need it, there's so many places I go now where I've been there so many times, so I know it like the back of my hand.
Yeah, like you're basically our navigation equipment for that trip.
Yeah.
You've been there like two or three times in the past.
I think that was my fourth time.
Yeah.
Just like more recently too. I just like, okay, yeah, it's over there. But it's always a good thing to have. It's always good to have that practical setting to practice on them, because it's one thing to be in your living room working with a map and compass, but you don't really have a practical area to be like, okay, I see that over there, working on your landmarking, mm-hmm. working on aiming off.
Go to a park, practice in a town park. Stuff.
So it's good to have that and understanding just the scale of the map, how to really properly like
gauge things,
gauge where you are.
And there's waterproof maps out there, but even those I've seen get pretty beaten up on trips.
Because you take a little more liberties with whatever you think something's bomb-proof.
Yeah.
So it ends up just as a crumbled mess at the end of it.
Yes.
Like we talked about sea lion packs before, is having those sea lion map cases, which
they're
will be
my favorite.
They'll have like a Ziploc, and then you can even roll it over a few times just to really secure it. You can keep your compass inside, you can keep your map inside.
Mm-hmm.
I've even kept like my InReach device or Spot device inside there before.
Nice.
So it's nice just to keep all those navigation things together.
And what I usually end up doing with them is I get a couple of those like Night Eyes S clips.
Yeah.
Those little like almost like mini carabiners that are doubled.
Little plastic ones.
Yeah, I usually end up with the stainless steel ones. But
Their whole range.
Yeah, on most shoulder straps on packs, you usually have those little D rings. And what I like to do is I clip one on the side, on my left side, then the other ring on the other. And so my map case is always on the pack and it's right there in front of me. I can always pull the map up and look. I can always see where I'm going. And then I go, and what I do with a compass is I carry multiples. I'm a bit of a compass. Like even as we're sitting here, I've got one of my old Silva compasses sitting right here. It's a Silva starter made in Sweden. I always have one in like a cargo short pocket and then one in my pack and then one in the canoe or the map case. Cause I'm always paranoid about, is the compass working well?
Yeah.
People panic when they think that they're lost and they'll start assuming the compass is broken.
Yeah.
But if both compasses are pointing the same way, you can't argue that. So it's a good way. I've had it on one trip where somebody argued me for like 10 minutes straight. Like, we're lost, man. We're lost. That compass is wrong. Compass got to be wrong, man. And he starts talking like Alec Baldwin in The Edge with Anthony Hopkins. That doesn't feel like South, John.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And so I pulled out the second compass. Like, can you still argue it? Okay, and it calms them down when you can confirm that way.
I'll have my top of line like Silva or something like that
Sunto.
On me with, that has the mirror folded up and
the proper navigational compass
and stuff like that. And then we'll just have one of these basic ones that you've got, just like a little flat plastic with that has some of the tools that you'll need, and then that's what I just toss inside the case. Just
perfect.
In case like you need to pass it around, one person doesn't have a compass, but now they do.
So compass and map case. The map case is just a brilliant system because it reinforces the map. It's not going to get damaged, but also reinforces that you should have it on you because it's right on the pack.
The thing is, too, when you have that case, it really allows you to fold the map into the piece part that you're using for that day.
Right, so you never get confused.
Now you're having to unfold it again. And
find your spot.
But you can really kind of set it up before you get out on the water to have it, okay, this is our route for the day, everything's in sight, everything's set to go, and it'll stay like that within the case.
Totally.
All flattened out.
What other things could we, like, as I mentioned at the beginning, or near the beginning, the canoe allows us to carry more. So there's some people out there that want to bring, like, everything and the kitchen sink. The canoe world is kind of there for them for that in a lot of ways. You still have to be mindful that a portage is 5K. You got to hump that stuff out. So it's like you still got to be within reason. But this is the world of like where you see people bringing a cast iron pot camping or cast iron pan.
That's the thing I've talked about in our previous podcast, just talking about what your goals are for that trip.
Totally.
If you're looking to cover hundreds of kilometers and miles and you want to go ultralight, you want to set some good speedy days, then just go ultralight, bring a minimalist setup.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's other times, it gives you that freedom. That's what I like about canoeing, is it gives you a vehicle in the backcountry to kind of carry everything, as long as you're ready to carry it across a portage, depending on if you've got 7 kilometer portages or if you're just doing a little bit of puddle jumps,
yeah,
stuff like that, like we were doing before.
Yeah,
100 kilometer followed by like a 400 meter, not kilometer.
100 kilometer, yeah. We don't do portage de prairie. We don't do that.
Yeah.
We hop little places. I think the worst I ever did was Alder Isle up in Algonquin Park, and that was an absolute nightmare of a portage.
Yeah.
But that's more because it wasn't heavily maintained, and it's a very angled, high angle portage. But yeah, you could bring on a trip like this, like when we're talking about like stoves. You can bring a camp stove. We were talking about in the first episode, the backpacking episode.
You can bring your pocket rocket.
Yeah, well, small.
So you can bring your big setup. There's some people who like really interchange their car camping equipment and stuff. They're like, I normally do car camping, but we're doing a backcountry trip this year in Algonquin, so I'm just going to bring my Coleman 2-burner stove sort of thing. Like,
yeah, and they're the ones that suffer.
Yeah.
But like you brought your Dragonfly from MSR. I love that model. I've had that since I was like 14 or 15. I had that same stove.
Yeah, the little fold-up pocket ones are great, but it's really nice to have a good sturdy stove,
yeah,
as well as one that you have a little more control on.
And more fuel.
Yeah.
And more options available, because you can, like with a pocket rocket or the Jeti by Vargo, these little isobutane little canister stoves. It's boil or that's it. You don't have a lot of range. With the Dragonflies and other similar ones, like I think the Whisper Lights, the International, yeah, Whisper Light, you can really adjust the heat. So you could be doing a saute, or you could be stir-frying, or you could be boiling water, or you could be like practically doing any kind of, you can treat it like a stovetop. And it makes your life a lot easier. It makes your diet a lot more varied, and you can have a lot more fun with your food.
Even I like playing around with biofuel stoves once in a while.
Yeah.
You got your BioLite, you got your Solo stoves, and even your friend Mikhail.
Yeah, the Emberlet, actually Emberlet sitting underneath me right now in a couple pieces. I got to put it back together.
Yeah, there's people who will play around with that sort of thing, but it depends on where you're going and what you want to do. If you don't be complaining on the portage, if you're like, oh my God. But sometimes that's like you do it the first time, you complain, and then you're like, next time I'm going a little lighter.
And that's what I've been doing since we did that trip. It was like, how could I have made that? My pack was my biggest mistake, was having a waterlogged backpack. And then everything got heavier because of that.
It's a good thing. Like, you kind of evolve and learn every trip. That's keeping logbooks and stuff like that. That's one thing. That's always a good little thing that I discussed there when I got into guiding, was keeping a logbook and kind of really writing everything down, keeping notes about what you needed for next time, what you can do without next time, sort of things. So it really gives you some tangible research to go.
Yeah.
Okay.
And on that, we had on our trip, we had an MSR Waterworks filter that we had for pumping if we were out in the canoe.
Yeah.
But then we also had a Gravity Work from Platypus with us. And then you had an MSR dromedary bag.
Yeah, because the MSR Gravity Flow system is pretty much exactly the same as Platypus. I think they're all owned by Cascade Designs.
Yep.
So they're all very similar manufacturing.
Probably just different labeling.
Probably the same factory that it comes all from.
More than likely.
Because even just the little inline filter that comes with both of them is exactly the same.
Just different colors.
Different logos and stuff like that. One's blue and gray. The other one's kind of
black and red. Yeah. And that's the beauty is, like, we can carry that kind of amount of a gear. You can bring more clothes. Like, if I was on a backpacking trip at the same time of year, I probably would have brought my wool jacket with me like I did, or that zip-up poly one that I had.
Well, even with, like, the water pumps and stuff like that, I've been on group trips where we had two of those, but then you have someone that's always standing down on the shoreline, just pumping away on it, and they're like, I've been here for half an hour, I've done 2 liters.
And that was me, the one that where I was just like, I don't want to wait for the gravity water. I just want water now.
And then you get the smallest crack in your hose. And then all of a sudden, it's not doing anything. There's no water coming out. And you're like, crap, we got to go back to like the water tablets and stuff like that. Which is always a good thing to keep in your emergency
redundancies.
Kit.
Always redundancies.
Your little chlorine tabs and stuff like that. Ketamine makes some.
Micropure. The iodine ones are... I don't mind the iodine ones. I know that they're more effective on certain.
You have your two-part water drop in your systems where you drop a little bit of this, a little bit of that. They react together.
Yep. We talked about that actually on the water episode way back. I think it was like episode 5 or 6.
Yeah.
We've done 20 episodes. This is such a weird feeling.
A year from now, I'll be like, over it. Episode 200.
Well, if we're going by like weekly, we'd be doing 52 episodes a year, which is strange because that's when I'm like, we're at episode 20, and there's only 52 weekends in the year. That's kind of crazy that we're almost at the halfway point of our podcast. It's almost emotional.
For this year.
For this year. In like a year or two, we're going to be like, can we stop doing this?
We'll be here 15 years later, episode 1000, we'll be Joe Rogan level.
And we'll just be like, we'll be yelling conspiracy theories in the basement.
That's all we'll have left to talk about.
Yeah, by then, just conspiracy theories and the occasional camping trip we may have just gone on.
Back on track.
So we're talking about like other gear you can bring that you wouldn't bring on a camp on a backpacking trip, but you can definitely do on a canoe trip. I'm trying to think of like what's some out there stuff that you love to bring with you on a canoe trip that you don't take backpacking. You definitely wouldn't take backpacking.
I think like I know guys who will backpack with cast iron. It's something they must have with them.
Radek almost did that, but I think we talked him out of it.
Yeah, there's been a few cast iron pieces I've kind of refurbished over this lockdown, but. I typically go away from that. I don't mind having stainless steel pans and pots titanium. And stuff like that. Things that you can multi-use over a fire if you want to go down a little extra bit. Yeah. You might use your stove at all times.
I remember those chairs.
Oh, yeah.
I was so jealous of you guys with those chairs.
Yeah, the Helinox that I had, that's the name brand, but then every store...
Sale
and stuff like that have their own store brand version for $60 or maybe for $100, and then they have the other ones that can go up to like $200-$300.
Those were genius, and I was so angry that you guys had those
big long backrests with a little pillow at the top and a cup holder in the armrest. That's a big thing too. Is it you know, like those ones like the Helinox ones and just the sick little ones? That's all you really need. But then you can work your way up to armrests and stuff like that. Something to lean your arms on after a big long day of paddling.
And for those not knowing what we're talking about, we're not talking about like your classic like director's chair looking camp chairs. We're talking like these are they're practically tent pole rigs for the legs.
They got the same whole elastic inside core that holds everything together.
Like how big is that thing, would you say, in like inches long when you pack it down?
When I pack it down lengthwise, I think it's probably around like 16 inches sort of thing.
Under 2 feet.
Yeah, it's under 2 feet, and then it's only like 4 or 5 inches wide sort of thing.
And it's tiny. Like, this thing looked like it was minuscule in the equipment you brought, but I wouldn't have taken that backpacking.
And even the bag it comes with can be looped underneath for a little storage pocket underneath that I was using it. Like,
that was the nifty part. Radek saw that because he had almost the same one, but just from a different brand. And he saw you do that, and he immediately took apart his chair and put it back together with that and like looked so happy. That was the... It was like almost like the highlight of the trip for him. Yeah. Was like, I can use that as a storage unit.
Yeah.
And it was great. But
things is within arm's reach. It's just reach underneath the end.
And all the while I'm sitting on like rocks and logs and having them roll around. I'm having to lay on the ground. Yeah. And I'm looking at you two guys actually looking civil.
Even these days, like it's nice to get up off the ground and be able to stretch your legs. But there are nice like little cushions. You get those closed cell foam, just cut a piece of closed cell foam off an old camping pad and give yourself a little some squish, even though you'll compact that down pretty quick.
Yep. And that was another thing I was thinking about because Becky Mason, who's I don't think I have to tell anybody that's into canoeing knows who Becky. Yeah. Becky Mason is the queen of the canoe world in my eyes. Father was Bill Mason, for those that you didn't know, the water walker himself. But there's a video of her when she was with Ray Mears when he was doing the Birch Park Canoe Boat with Pinnock. And she was doing a classic paddle sit that we were talking about before where you are sitting more on the edge of the canoe than in the middle. And the canoe tips up about a 30-degree, 45-degree incline, and you're paddling on one side of the canoe only with a sea stroke or Canadian stroke. And she was doing that kneeling, not sitting, which is probably the better way to do it. But she was using her sleeping pad as a kneeling pad. And talking back about the PFD thing, that's a better option. Now you have padding that you can be on that you know can handle that kind of abuse.
Even like when I've ran camps where I've instructed all summer long and done stuff like, even if you go to the dollar store, they have those little gardening knee pads.
Yeah, and the yoga mats and stuff.
Yeah, because they just have like, it's a nice half inch thick at least of foam. And it's just a little rectangle cutout with even a little handle on it too. But I just put that underneath your knees, you're good to go. Because it's not something that's stationary. Because they'll have some like whitewater canoes and Royalex canoes that already have little cutouts of foam on the bottom. So it's kind of built in. But
I really miss Royalex.
Yeah. It's nice to, just to have that little cutout piece. Like sometimes you have to like roll it over a bunch of times when it's a, just that thin blue close cell foam mat.
Yeah.
But it's nice to have that redundancy and those double uses for things, because then you can use that as your buck pad.
And that's, and again, going back to the sleeping pad, instead of carrying an extra pad, you can use the sleeping pad as a kneeling pad. You can use it as a sit spot.
Although I would steer away from using that as your kneeling pad inside a canoe if you want to sleep on that at night. If you're in October and get all your closed cell foam
wet,
because you get those like Sea to Summit Thermarest sleeping pads that have the foam on the inside. If you get water in there, you're screwed, because you run into mold issues. And all that
Very true.
So it's just something to think about. But they even make like little butt cushion size ones. Do I have one of those at Thermarest? One of those just the exact same design as their sleeping pads, but just for a little seat to get you. If you're in Killarney and all you have is rocks to sit on, then it's nice just to give yourself a little something. They blow up just that little bit. So you
Oh, we're talking about the inflatable ones. Just thinking closed cell foam, like the solid foam.
This one's like the inflatable ones. That's like the roll-up mattress style. It's like the whoopee cushion sort of
Right.
The foam that just kind of releases.
Inflates a bit. So clever.
There's tons of stuff out there, but you don't have to go spending tons of money. Just get yourself an old closed cell foam. That's where it helps to kind of look around. Shops, anyone you know, if you have grandparents or aunts and uncles, cousins that you know of that have extra gear, then always go look around them first before you go through and try to buy the newest technology.
And check out, like we talked about this on our very first episode of the podcast, we talked about buying gear smart. You can look on Facebook Marketplace, you can look on Kijiji, you can find so much gear out there. State sales, Value Village, thrift stores. They all exist for our benefits. And so we kind of beat this dead horse pretty well on canoe gear, I think. Anything else you can think of with the last few minutes of the episode?
Well, I think with tents, you can take a little more.
That's true.
With you. You don't want to be taking that 40-pound big old
tent. No.
That some Sultan would use. The desert sort of thing, where it's like
Bear Grylls,
12-person tent. But
no thanks.
You can take it. You can have a little more liberty with what you take. You can have a little more space.
Definitely.
Especially since, like, when you get ratings for tents, it's like shoulder to shoulder, wall to wall sort of thing.
Yeah.
So always size one up. If you're having two people, get a 3-person tent.
Yeah.
So on. So it's always nice to do that. But tents these days, they can make some bomb proof. Lightweight ones, and then
my hammocks
and stuff like that. It's always.
I was kind of wishing I brought a bigger tarp on that trip, but at the same time, I never really needed it.
Yeah.
But I'm that guy that prefers a big tarp over a small tarp because I want to have as much room dry as possible.
Yeah.
So on a canoe trip, I could take a 13x15 tarp if I wanted. I didn't, but I could have very easily and would have added much weight more to my kit.
Companies like Wrap. Really good lightweight.
I look at them.
Stuff like that. They're really nice. They'll be a little. Some of them are expensive as a tent themselves, but
they'll
be good shelters for it. Oh, you just want to go with big bags, hammocks, and all that sort of thing. So
we were having one struggle on that trip with tents, and that was sushi.
Yeah. Dogs in general. Yeah. It's a real learning curve.
It is, and that's her first. That was her first canoe trip. That was her third camping trip. And she's never really been comfortable in a tent, especially when we have people in separate tents, because she's a shepherd dog. She's a herding dog. The herd's broken up. I got to get them back together. So luckily we were on an island and she didn't like to swim. So she basically ran rampant all through the night, would hang out with me and then go over, sniff around your tents in the middle of the night. But at one point, Radek was trying to keep her and Misha, his dog, in his tent. And that was not a good idea. So be mindful if you're bringing your four-legged friends. From my experience, this is my first time taking her on a canoe trip. First off, get a PFD for your dog. Don't be that person that doesn't think about their dog's safety. They can swim. She swam 500 kilometers. Well, I'm doing that too. 500 meters on her own volition, but she had a life jacket on that whole time. Get a life jacket for your dog. Make sure you train them slowly with a lot of rewards and a lot of approval and a lot of praise, and get them comfortable in the canoe before you try to do, you know, like a Killarney trip or a big trip up the Tomogamy or something.
Even if you have the luxury of a backyard or something, get them used to it. Camp out a couple of nights in your backyard at home. If you can find somewhere to car camp, take your dog there so they get comfortable with it. I think it's a little difficult because you're trying to put her in Radic's tent.
And I'm over there.
While you're across the site in your hammock and stuff like that. She's like, "Dad, where are you? Dad."
And it was the same thing as when we took her winter camping with us in the big tent. She did not want to be in the tent with everybody. She wanted to be outside, and she quickly learned how to get the zipper open on the tent, so I had to go sleep outside with her. But learn to work with your animals if you're planning on taking dogs, because dogs can be an amazing addition to the trip. They can be real fun. I think most of the canoe trip, when we weren't in the canoes, we were just playing with the dogs and just throwing frisbees into the water and teaching Sushi how to enjoy swimming. And by the end, She was jumping in on her own. She never has liked to swim, but she was jumping in to join us.
Even another, just going off of that and getting the dog to PFD, I think the point I want to make is you go through so many places, and even on Instagram, you'll see every photo taken, no one's wearing a PFD. And I think I've heard so many stories, even from like seasoned veterans and stuff like that. One little thing goes wrong, like I was saying, you don't really notice how tired you are after a day of paddling with the legs and the arms, and you get tipped, you get separated from your canoe and everything in it, you're scrambling because then your PFD was at the bottom underneath your seat, now it's trapped in the canoe. And
have you ever tried to put a PFD on when you're floating?
It's fighting you the whole way because you got to get it underwater to get it on you, unless you were somehow able to be Aquaman and get your whole torso above the water. But I think it just goes in the whole having respect for the conditions you're in. And if it's something that you're going to be doing on the regular for the rest of your life, invest in a decent PFD.
Yeah.
Something you feel comfortable wearing. Go into the shop, try it on. Try on a bunch of different ones. Sometimes you'll get someone who knows exactly how to fit it, but just do all your own research, do due diligence, and really make sure it's something you're comfortable with wearing, something that's properly made for where you're going and all that stuff, fitted, understanding how it's supposed to be. Because I had so many people when I was selling life jackets and canoes being like, "Oh, how do I do this? How do I do that?" And like, especially you get parents with young kids who want to buy the size up and get yourself a large, and oh, they'll grow into it. His dad's 6'5" and stuff like that. But
cool, the kid will drown now, though.
Yeah. You want something that'll keep your head above water. You don't want that PFD rising up above your ears while your face is in the water, sort of thing. So really get something, because they make so many streamlined models these days. I have the Salus Proto, which is kind of like a cross between a white water PFD and everything. It has pockets.
I was checking that out on you. That was a pretty good looking PFD.
Well, those ones are great. It has like good lashing points for a knife. Mm-hmm. In case you're doing water and around ropes and stuff that you can get snagged on, and you want to have a good water knife. And then it also has stuff for, like, you can put a camelback in there. You can hold a 2-liter
no doubt
camelback bladder, and it can even come right down the arm strap. Nice padded arm strap, not just like the little nylon straps. It'll cost you a pretty penny, but if it's something that you're going to be using for a while, then it's always going to be a little safer.
So I think we kind of covered everything we can. I want to thank you all for tuning in. Hopefully this helps you out with your trip coming up. We have a long weekend left.
There's so much more we can cover with that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Goes more into the lecture. Maybe we'll do videos and stuff down the line. Really
definitely. We've got all the equipment finally back, folks. We're going to be doing videos on YouTube and Facebook very, very soon. We're just getting a few more pieces figured out and optimized and formatted. But on that, I want to thank you all for tuning in. I want to thank you, Ryan, again for joining us here.
Anytime, I'll go back to my place over
up on the shelf over there. Some people got an elf on a shelf. I got a rye on a shelf. It doesn't rhyme, but still works. But anyways, I want to thank you all for tuning in. Please be safe on the water this season and next season and forever, really. Take care of yourselves. We'll talk about paddles. Paddles are good. We could talk about canoes too, like canoe selection and paddles as well.
I'm getting to that point where I'm realizing all the stuff I forgot to talk about.
We could definitely do that. Don't worry. We'll do another one. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Hey there, Dragonfly Nation. I hope you're enjoying this wholesome, sometimes deranged content. We here at Canadian Bushcraft love creating it. We do this podcast along with our live feed videos and several other projects for free to make sure information is shared far and wide to everyone. But if you'd like to help support this project and our other variety of projects, we would be so appreciative. You can find a link to our Patreon account in the information section of this podcast episode. As a patron, you will gain our undying love and admiration, and depending on the tier you choose, you will also get a few kickbacks in return. These include weekly patron-only articles, monthly one-on-one video sessions with myself or other staff to help you with the skills you're trying to hone at home, and also content such as this podcast 1 week sooner than the public gets it. You also get to have input on upcoming episodes as well as any future videos we produce. As a small business who wish to remain sponsor-free, we appreciate any and all support from our fans and followers. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a good day.